Good morning. We'll call the Sussex County Council meeting of May 19, 2015 to order. First thing is the approval of the agenda. Mr. Lawson.
Thank you, Mr. President, and good morning, members. We have one amendment this morning. We can delete the approval of minutes.
Any motion to approve the agenda as amended? Motion, Mr. Wilson. Second, Mr. Cole. Any questions on the vote? Take the call. Mrs. Deaver?
Yes.
Mr. Cole?
Yes.
Mr. Arnett?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried. Correspondence, Mr. Moore?
I have none, Mr. President.
Any correspondence from council?
Yes, sir.
Cole?
I got a thank you. I attended, and Mr. Joe Conaway was there also, and some other people. With the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary Incorporated, it was at a reception, and they just basically informed us about what they were doing, and it takes in three states, and they're doing some projects up around Lewis, so I attended that.
More correspondence from council? Next on agenda is public comments. Okay. Michael Horn.
Good morning. My name is Michael Horn. My address is 46 Atlantic South in Bethany Beach. I want to speak to the question whether the council should or the county should appeal the cell tower decision recently issued. And if this is the appropriate time to do that, I will.
You have 3 minutes, sir. Yes, sir. Help yourself.
Thank you very much. I represent the Bethany Beach Landowners Association, or BBLA as we call it. We have approximately 11,000 members. Member households, about 21,000 people. We have consistently supported Sea Pines Village in opposing the cell tower application, and have appeared numerous times before the Board of Adjustment and submitted written communications. We believe the county should appeal the court decision because we think not only it's erroneous and not only are we unhappy with the result, but we think the decision is seriously flawed, and there's a very good prospect that it will be reversed by the Supreme Court. Court purported to modify the decision, which in effect rewrote the decision, and it seems to us usurped the power of the Board of Adjustment in doing that. Unless there are questions, that's all I have to say.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Pollinger? Pollinger?
No, I thought that was just a signage. I'm sorry. That was all
right. Okay, your phone. No, that's fine. Hack Jones? You're good? Okay.
We'll give you 3 minutes. Talk about anything.
Richard Hebeck?
Morning.
Morning.
I am a 25-year resident of Sussex County and of Mallard Lakes. I have owned my condo townhouse for 22 years. I have been asked to speak before the county council today to represent my neighbors and friends and to put on record our concerns about the situation we have been living with since Superstorm Sandy has devastated our lives and substantially damaged our homes. We are a diverse group of residents, some with families with small children, senior citizens, retired folks on a fixed income, year-round owners who make Mallard Lakes our only residence, and those who have units as a second home and looking forward to retiring to Sussex County in the future. From the day Sandy came and went from Mallard Lakes, the Mallard Lakes Board has assumed total responsibility for the mitigation and reconstruction of our homes. They alone have hired all the contractors, signed all the paperwork, and made all the decisions without ever asking us what we want, even though the bylaws clearly state that a meeting of all homeowners' substantially damaged homes be convened within 90 days to review, assess, and decide how reconstruction is to be determined or if it is beyond repair. We were deliberately denied this voice. We were never told to leave our homes, and in fact, there was at least one resident who remained in her home through the mitigation and reconstruction process, even though the units were determined substantially damaged. As the work was completed, we were allowed to move back into our homes, but were never given any certification that the homes had been inspected by licensed engineers concerning mold, bacteria, stability, electric, and meeting the Sussex County requirements for certificate of occupancy. Many of us were concerned as to why the subflooring was not replaced. We were told by the general contractor that it was not necessary, even though we had two independent contractors who said otherwise. A few months after moving back into our homes, at least 9 homeowners had issues with floors buckling. Those owners did not have carpet on the first floor, so the damage was more apparent. This issue has still not been resolved, though engineers came in, cut through several owners' floors to determine the cause. The Mallard Lakes Board did not recognize these independent engineers' reports and have not shared the reports done by Lincoln and Hancock. To this day, our floors still remain damaged. What this demonstrates, as only one example, is how the Mallard Lakes Board has handled the damage to our homes. Being consistent in their dealings with us, the Mallard Lakes Board has not asked our opinion on removing the substantial damage claim to our homes. They have yet to honestly act on our behalf unless it meets their objective to keep costs down. The adage of penny wise, pound foolish comes to mind. What the board has spent in high-priced legal fees would have gone a long way to resolving our misfortune and throwing roadblocks up to resolve this issue. We have been threatened that if a substantial damage claim remains, the Mallard Lakes community may segregate our homes and we would have to pay a higher premium for flood insurance from the rest of the development, making us victims once again. This would be an 18% increase annually, not to exceed $2,500 per year until we meet the premium for the current value of our homes of about $200,000. This has been brought up at several board meetings. We want the substantial damage claim to remain. If it is removed, it is as if Superstorm Sandy never happened. Melissa A. Anderson from the Interim Office of Flood Insurance Advocate for FEMA wrote to us stating the substantial damage declaration would be important on terms of mitigating these properties from future flood damage. It would save you and our families from the devastating effects of flood. All we want is our homes to be raised to a safe and healthy environment to live, in an environment to live, meeting all the requirements of Sussex County without the fear of threats from Mallard Lakes Board. With Sussex County lowering the flood level plane to 4 feet, all 4 buildings still do not meet the standards required for certificate of occupancy. Lowering the floodplain requirements does not provide us with the safety and security we need. The threat of flood remains present with every nor'easter or storm. Early on, there was a meeting with Mallard Lakes Board, and it was determined if every homeowner was assessed $1,200 or a loan was taken out over a 15 to 30 year time frame, these 4 buildings could be raised. The Mallard Lakes Board rejected this idea. At a recent Mallard Lakes Board meeting, I personally voiced my concern about not having a certificate of occupancy. I said I could not sell my home without it. The board treasurer said out loud, "Sell your home for a dollar, then you'll sell it." This is the attitude of the Mallard Lakes Board and why we do not want the substantial damage claim removed for the 24 homeowners on the island who are still living with this nightmare with no end in sight. We are only 24 voices against the Mallard Lakes Board and their intimidating law firm, but with your support, we are standing strong and want to be heard loud and clear. We know you want this travesty resolved, and it can only be done by raising our homes to a safe and secured height. My neighbors and I cannot figure out how we turned out to be the bad guys in this mess. We have given our board every opportunity to do the right thing, and now all we get are letters from the law firm of Whitford, Taylor, and Preston in Wilmington telling us all communication can only go through them. Our only ray of hope is remembering the story of David and Goliath. We ask you to stand with us. Thank you.
Do we have copies of all those letters you're talking about?
We.
That's something you want.
We have copies of it.
Yes, have you sent any copies? You talked about the letter from FEMA.
I can get you the letters. I was just emailed yesterday the response that Melissa Anderson gave. But there is someone that has some of the records. But a lot of the records, we went through the ombudsman process, and with the first complaint, we did two complaints. With the first one, the lawyer sent us a list of 199 questions that we had to answer within 10 days. Most of those records we do not have. We've been asking for that information. And now we were told that we would have to go up to Legum and Norman. We would have to pay to look at the information. We would have to find it ourselves, pay to look at it. And we would have to sign a disclosure form that we could not reveal what was read. So that really ties our hands on almost all the 199 questions.
And what are you asking from the county at this point?
We understand that the board has been trying to have the substantial damage claim removed, and we do not want it removed, because if it's removed, it's like the storm never happened, and if we were to be flooded again.
Well, that's what part does the county have in that? Anybody know? Could anybody?
Yes. We have been asked by the board and have been speaking to the board and the attorney in the law firm referenced this morning. To look at removing the substantial damage indication or label by FEMA.
The board wants it removed.
The board does.
They don't want it removed. Okay. And where do we stand in that debate? I mean, is it a private issue, or what are we? That's my concern.
The debate between the board and the residents is clearly a private issue.
Okay.
And it's my understanding that the state ombudsman is involved. There's also complaints that are have been registered with the state as it relates to Sandy damaged homes and what has taken place. And it's my understanding that Mallard Lakes are engaged in that and that means of relief. I don't know. I'm actually the one that is guiding the county's response. Mm-hmm. And I'm torn between the association asking and the residents asking. And at the end of the day, The county just wants what's best for the residents. And also, let me clarify the statement. The county didn't lower the base flood elevation. FEMA lowered the base flood elevation from 7 to 4. The county actually appealed that lowering from 7 to 4, and we were denied by FEMA. So that was a federal designation. So I've had conversations as late as yesterday about this with the association's attorney. We haven't picked sides. We just want to do what's best. The problem with these properties, one is at 4 feet, which is now the base flood elevation. The other are tenths of a foot below the federally designated base flood elevation, and it's going to cost $1 million to raise them. And FEMA would not allow us to just waive the elevation certificates.
Even the one building that is at 4 feet, all the plumbing and HAV is below the 4 feet.
Correct. Correct.
Okay, this is not a place for conversation.
Sorry. That's fine.
I'm sure
it's
the
complicated.
County is doing everything that we can do.
Lost
on our
short working on this. So.
But we just want to make our voice heard because the board is making their voice heard.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for being here, sir.
Lou D'Amico.
My name is Lou D'Amico. I'm here for the vending part of.
Okay, the public hearing. Okay,
yes.
We'll get that in about 5 minutes. Thank you. Joseph Morris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. My name is Joseph Morris. I live at 19818 Beaver Dam Road in Lewis, Delaware. I'm here to speak in opposition for the conditional permit. For Mr. J. Beach, the property adjacent to mine.
There's going to be a public hearing on that this afternoon, sir.
Yeah.
And any of the comments concerning that would need to take place at that public hearing.
And that, what time is that, sir?
It is scheduled for 1:30. There are three hearings scheduled. Mm-hmm. I can't recall which order that is. If it's one, it's the first one.
First one.
So it'll be at 1:30, sir.
Yes,
sir.
And what you say will be part of, will be your testimony will be part of the entire decision.
So thank you very much, Ms. Stevens.
Greg Cox.
Good morning. My name is Greg Cox, and I own number 4 Sea Pines Village down at Bethany Beach. And I was asked by the board of directors at Sea Pines Village to read an email letter that was sent to Mr. Sharp from our resident attorney in our community, David Girk. So I would like to proceed with that.
Certainly. Got 3 minutes.
We would very much expect the county will be appealing this decision to the Supreme Court of Delaware in light of the obvious legal errors in which the judge has abused her discretion by retrying the case and did reweight the evidence, something clearly prohibited under the Delaware statute and longstanding Supreme Court of Delaware case law. Ever before has a Delaware judge changed a board's decision by completely changing and flipping the outcome of the Board of Adjustment ruling, as she has done here. That is because, as you yourself know very well, the statute and case law explicitly prohibits what she has done, retrying the factual hearing. We would like to confirm the county's intention to appeal, as this overreaching decision has a significant and dire impact on the community if left unchallenged. At best, the judge was empowered to vacate the decision, which would have required a new application be started from scratch. Were judges on appeal empowered to act further as she has done here, the Supreme Court of Delaware, in its opinion deciding the previous application for this tower, would have stepped in and made a definitive ruling to approve or deny the application themselves. They did not and stated that they could not because the law is clear that an appellate judge cannot change the outcome of the board's decision on appeal, as this is a matter of discretion before the board to weigh the facts and make a decision. Delaware case law and relevant statutes are very clear that even if the judge disagrees with the decision, they cannot substitute their opinion for the board. Judge Brady amazingly even recites case law on page 21 of the attached opinion that expressly states she is not empowered to do the very thing she has done, change the outcome of the case. The standard under which a court reviews a decision of the Board of Adjustment is deferential. The board's decision should be disturbed only in limited circumstances, so long as the board's conclusions are A, supported by substantial evidence in the record, and B, free from legal error. The board's decision must stand. Even if the court itself would have decided otherwise, under 29 Delaware 10142D, the court's review is limited to matters of law, and the court is bound by the facts presented before the administrative board in the instant matter. The fact she labeled what she did a modification does not change the fact her actions exceeded her power. What she did clearly cannot be properly labeled a modification, otherwise it would eviscerate the wording and meaning of the statute. Further, even if she were empowered to retry the case from the appellate bench, she failed to look at the facts and relied upon arguments from the appellant without looking to the actual record. For example, she relies on the appellate's assertion that the tower will not be in the water, even though their own site plan shows the tower in the water, as opposition identified in the proceedings. She also stated the fact that this is the third application as a reason to approve it. That statement demonstrates a clear predisposition to approve the case. And just to pause here for a second, I did go through the her decision. And she says, this one is personal. This happens to relate to something that I presented in the hearing early on. She said, the data on which Mr. Cox based his opinion that units near the tower sold for less was seriously flawed. First, Mr. Cox extrapolated from an inadequate sample size of only 4 sales. I have my original spreadsheet here, where I took every sale from 2003 through 2013, every sale, which totaled 22 sales. And I clearly laid it out on the spreadsheet. Nothing was left out. So I don't know where she gets 4 from 23, but I think it's a substantial sample size, being that it's every sale that took place. She also stated...
Hey, if you could kind of speed up a little bit.
Okay. She also stated the fact that this is the statement demonstrates a clear predisposition to approve the case. She failed to do her job, relying on appellate argument rather than the factual record. As an attorney for practicing over 15 years, including federal appellate litigation, I unquestionably believe this decision to be ripe with legal errors. It should be appealed because hundreds of citizens will be harmed and will have effectively been deprived of their legal due process by the judge stealing the discretion that lies solely with the Board of Adjustment. Additionally, it is also important for the county to appeal and remove this bad precedent from the legal case law, or else all future decisions of the board will be attacked under this decision and will be susceptible for judicial reworking.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cox.
We're going to move on the agenda now to our 10:15 advertised public hearing. Mr. Moore?
Yes, this is the time and place for a public hearing on an ordinance to amend Chapter 115, Article 10, Section 69 and 72, Article 11, Section 77 and 80, and Article 21A, Sections 83.2 and 83.6 of the Code of Sussex County relating to temporary removable vendor stands. On behalf of the county, Mr. Vincent, Assistant County Attorney, and Lawrence Lank will make a presentation to the council. After that, the council will have an opportunity to ask questions, and then following that, any member of the public that would like to address this issue may do so. Mr. Vincent.
Mr. Robertson.
I'm sorry.
Either he got a demotion or I got a promotion. I'm not sure which.
Sorry about that. Too many Vincents.
It'd be a big pay raise for me, I can assure you.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, boy.
We've been in front of council a couple times on this as we were drafting it. The final version of the ordinance that was introduced dealt with adding a provision for temporary removable vendor stands having to do with food trucks, agricultural products, the sale of food in the CR1, C1, and then we added B1. And the idea was that if you were truly temporary and you were small in scale and you were not a permanent structure on a piece of property, you shouldn't have to go through the big process of having to get a conditional use. Actually, at the Planning and Zoning Commission hearing where this was discussed, one attorney in an email said they had to go through the zoning trifecta. They were at Planning and Zoning, County Council, and the Board of Adjustment, which is really somewhat unusual for any application, let alone a really small food truck or vegetable stand type thing in a C1 or CR1 or B1 ordinance. So what it does is, if you meet certain criteria, you can get an approval from the Director of Planning and Zoning. It can't be permanently affixed. There can't be more than one temporary stand on a parcel. It can't be wider than 8 feet 6 inches wide or longer than 45 feet, which to Mr. Cole's question, that came from DLDOT regulations for being able to get down a road. It cannot be permanently connected to utilities, including water, sewer, electric, or gas. And it cannot interfere with vehicular or pedestrian movement. So if you meet those criteria, then what you would need to do is seek approval from Mr. Lank or the director. You would need written approval of the existence of the location of the stand from the property owner, drawings showing the location of the stand on the property. And then if the director has any concerns about the location, the size of the property, the effects on on-site parking, neighboring properties or roadways or other good cause, the director then can shift it into the Board of Adjustment for a special exception. So there's still sort of a kick out if there's concerns, which is still a streamlined process instead of having to come to Planning and Zoning and County Council. The public hearing was conducted by the Planning and Zoning Commission, and during the hearing, there was some correspondence that was submitted to the commission from an attorney who's represented several of these type of applications in favor of it, again, saying, you know, we shouldn't have to go through the zoning trifecta, but also saying that rather than the six-month duration that was in the ordinance, given sort of the needs and the typical uses of these, proposing that it be from March 15th through November 15th. which is a little bit longer. But I will tell you that the commission, and I think Mr. Lank may agree with this, but sort of thought, well, actually, in terms of trying to police these, that makes more sense. Everybody starts at the same time and everybody ends at the same time. If you just say 6 months, then the office would have to track each one when it started and when it would end, and they'd be all over the calendar year, and really it'd be tough to do. This way, you know that you can't have your stand till March 15th, and you'd have to have it removed by November 15th. Now, keep in mind, none of these regulations have any effect on produce stands that are already permitted in AR1. So that's not covered by that. And they wouldn't have any effect on, sort of the special event type things that are there for 3 days or whatever. So this is sort of the special category of warm weather type uses. So in light of the Planning and Zoning Commission's recommendation, staff sort of regrouped and talked about it a little more and agreed with that. Just to fine-tune it a little bit, there was a recommendation that there be an amendment to the proposed ordinance that would add a new Section I to each one that says the approval of the temporary removable vendor stand shall be valid for 1 year. The thought being that circumstances could change from year to year, and this way they can get a look at them each year just to make sure that the parking's the same, the vehicular movement's the same, that everything still suits that stand. And keep in mind, it's not a big process. You're bringing in a drawing and a letter from the property owner for the office to review. And then the final thing that staff considered was there's going to be time involved from the office's point of view in reviewing these. There's going to have to be record keeping. There's going to have to be a sticker that's issued approving the stand. What we've talked about is there'd be some annual color-coded sticker that would go somewhere on the stand so everybody would know it was approved. And given the costs of that, staff recommended an additional ordinance or amendment to the ordinance that would require an application fee of $100 just to cover that. I know Ms. Cornwell looked at some jurisdictions, and that was sort of in the middle of the range of those fees. We felt that it covered the actual cost incurred by the county in reviewing these and also looked at the difference between that cost and what it would cost if you went through the whole conditional use process and possibly the Board of Adjustment, which would be in filing fees and just all the other ancillary costs, probably $1,500 to $2,000 on the cheapest side. So we've thought that this was a reasonable cost related to the cost of the county for administering this process. So with that, that's really our presentation. There wasn't much public comment aside from that one email. There was a question about how it related to the AR stands at Planning and Zoning, and we answered that. But they moved it forward with a very positive recommendation. They felt that it was a good idea to get this going.
That was the commission?
Yes, okay. Yes.
I got a scenario. If somebody gets approval, gets the permit, mm-hmm. and it's placed, do we have, like the one outside of Rehoboth where the Rio Taco or whatever is close to the road, we've now proved it to be relocated. Do we go and check, Lawrence, to see, make sure it's been relocated? How long do we give them to relocate? Is there anything that...
The Taco Rio is located right next to the right-of-way of Route 1, and their proposal is to relocate it to public hearing back to the side of the liquid building.
Right.
And once we establish that site plan, they may need a variance for that location because it's closer to
that
airport.
Particular one. But let's just.
Well, we haven't seen that site plan yet.
Okay, I haven't seen it move either. So what my concern would be is if somebody comes in, gets a permit, then they go in and park it not where they show us on a drawing. They park it somewhere where it's not.
Then we have to go in and tell them to move it where it's supposed to be.
Well, that's the question. Yeah. Do we do any inspection to see if it's properly located, or are we going to again be a complaint-driven enforcement on this issue?
We would have to do an inspection.
We have, okay, so there will be an inspection. If they are improperly placed, what would be the procedure?
Cite them for basically a violation for not being in compliance with the site plan approval. We could probably even void their approval.
Okay, so you have the ability, that's what I'm trying to find out. If you have the ability that we give them a permit and they're supposed to be in this spot and you go down and they're not, and then we say, you're supposed to move, there's a certain amount of time you, I guess, you will give them? Or
well, typically, an issue like that, we'd usually give them 10 days, correct?
Okay, if they don't, if we go back for another inspection and they're still there, you can yank their permit?
Yank their permit.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, I just want to make sure that we got something in place for all this and that we don't need to have it in the ordinance, or we can just have it as policy and stuff like that.
Mr. Cole, we have developed a draft policy. It's draft at this point.
Okay, that's right.
Working with Ms. Cornwell, and I know you had that question. Obviously, we didn't want to get too far into the details because it depended on what the final ordinance would look like, but that's one thing it states in that policy, that it would be revoked if they didn't comply with the approval. And there's some other things that are.
And probably, I mean, if we end up having to go back three or four times in inspections, I mean, eventually that exceeds a $100 cost to the county.
That's right.
So we may want to look at that also, that there's an extra additional fee if you have to have additional inspections or something like that. And then the other thing I think we've talked about with tables, we pull up, there's no tables, and you go by and there's five tables.
What
is there a trigger?
The proposal that staff looked at for the policy, if there's more than one table, that it's looks like, or one table that with a capacity of over four people, then that would be something that would trigger them to have to go to the Board of Adjustment. Yeah.
So we trigger what? Having to go
through the Board of Adjustment. That gets them out of this expedited.
They don't get the permit. They have to go do something else.
Right, that's
okay.
Right.
Okay, just to get this permit, make it easy, make it fast, make it quick. Get the permit, get set up, but right. Just stay where you're, go where you say you are going to be going. Okay.
One table.
Mr. President, may I?
Yes, sir.
Just two comments. Number one is I know we're talking about doing it a seasonal start, finish, keep it simple. I hate to even throw out this question, but what about those who perhaps might want to sell Christmas trees in the winter?
We did talk about that. A lot of those, depending on where they're located, are potentially under the ag use permit.
Right.
And I don't know how Mr. Lank has treated those in the past, the ones that we have that now. So
we haven't really had to. Typically, the majority of them are located in towns. Like Food Line sells Christmas trees for couple weeks, just an example, but it hadn't been an issue.
Mm-hmm. And for example, the Christmas tree farms, that would be an agricultural use, and that's already permitted under the AR1. So,
just wondering, because we all know, sometimes there are stands out there that are not necessarily on a farm per se, and just wondering how we might want to consider handling that. That's number one. Number two is the $100 fee also the renewal fee every year? So they would physically have to show up again, or is it something that can be automated, renewed? What are the thoughts on that process?
We talked about that a little bit. They would have to show up, and I think the discussion we had was they could either bring the new letter in or they could pull the file from the prior one, and they could certify there's not been any changes. Again, we want to keep it as simple as possible.
Right. And then maybe it'll be part of our presentation a little bit later on this morning, but is this going to be online, these approvals with conditions and the company names and all those things? Are these going to be online?
We could entertain that, yeah. It could easily be put on our website in a new place, yes.
Okay. I would be certainly in support of that, for sure. But okay, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. You do know there will be people popping up without the permit. It's like everything else. So
sure.
They'll just go do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we thought that there would actually be a permit, but there would be an additional sticker, so right. The staff could see the sticker, they know that it's an official site that's been approved, because they wouldn't know it up front the first time, at least. Mm-hmm. And then they would, if they needed to ask questions, they go up and ask for their permit. Mm-hmm. They would be had to be available on site, just like any building permits, but it'd be posted, it would be the same.
Big sticker then, big sticker.
Right? Wilson.
Does this $100 nonprofit, how about a nonprofit organization? Is that included in here? Or like a nonprofit, for instance,
Girl Scouts?
Like the Lions and the Kiwanis and the VFW and those people, wouldn't actually have more than one table. Mm-hmm. How are they going to fit here in this category?
They're all pre-existing anyway. They came up with a new site, they may have to go through another process altogether.
So they're going to be given the...
Somebody like the Kiwanis Barbecues existed for years and years out on 404.
Sure.
And it's a temporary facility, but the building stays there. It's been that way for years.
Other words,
when it was considered permitted.
How about those that wants to start a new sale, just wants to start selling stuff here, as VFW or somebody like that wants to start selling chicken? They don't have this set up. Mm-hmm. Are they going to have to go through this whole rigmarole to get set up?
The majority of them aren't permanent. The majority of them would probably fall into that three-day provision three times a year, so they would create special dates that they would operate their chicken barbecue, for example. And typically that's a civic club or something of that nature, like BFW or whoever. But they don't do it every weekend.
Or what? I didn't hear the last
They part. Don't do it every weekend.
This only for every weekend, every day?
This would be for basically
8 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's for more permanent structures and a regular operation.
I know some BFWs sell every week, matter of fact. I don't know about Saturday, only on weekends, though.
Yeah.
But a weekend doesn't count. Is that correct?
No, it does. It's 7 days a week. I misspoke on that. So,
pardon?
Yeah. It's 7 days a week. If you were doing a regular operation, you know, whatever that may be, it would fall under this. Or if you didn't fall under this, you'd have to go to the Board of Adjustment or some other route, which is what you have to do now. So.
I understand. But I just wonder if what kind of cost it's going to cost our nonprofit people. Yeah. That people say like served in the services. We're going to turn around and charge them. How much could it cost? $1,000? Time to get started? Or?
Well, I mean, just like, you know, we've had VFWs and American Legions, you know, go through the zoning process for their facilities. Yeah, and it's I think that they're not waived fees. They're the same as everybody else. Yeah.
There's a lot of nonprofits out there nowadays, Sam, and what would happen is end up county would be subsidizing all these things.
Well, I'm particularly interested in, like, especially VFW veterans. I think that they don't they've done served enough when they go overseas and fight for our country and all these things.
Absolutely.
And to come to our county and get a hard time, that doesn't.
Well, we're trying to make.
I don't sit too well with my grain.
Yeah. I understand, and that's kind of one of the reasons because we look. Actually, the chicken barbecues were kind of one of the things that drove this, along with the vegetable stands. And we were looking at a way for the people that operated those to not have to spend thousands of dollars because we felt, again, to your point, that really was inherently unfair for the size of the use and the small business person to have to go through that much of a process at the end of the day to operate something that was fairly temporary.
Will they be required to pay $100 every year? Will they be grandfathered?
It'll be an annual fee. Yeah. And majority of them are going to stay in the same location. They're going to try to relocate a different on occasion.
If so they're already there, like let's use.
Can't be permanent. It's got to be temporary.
Let's use the VFW up to Allendale, Georgia.
They're grandfather. Anybody that's existing now, they wouldn't
have $100 or nothing.
No, this doesn't affect anybody that's in operation right now. That's
okay. It's good to know that. Yeah. I mean, it's good for them.
No, that's a good question.
Unless they're operating illegally.
Well, we don't have any of that.
Well, correct.
Yeah. Questions of council?
Yes.
Mrs. Deaver.
I love how you people who've been in government for many, many years use the term kick out, but I swear I don't know what you mean.
Well, it means like, you know, here's the...
What do you mean by...
Here's the path, and if you don't, if you don't track through that path, it sort of kicks it out into another path. So if you go through this, you know, and you meet all the criteria... you submit all your information and Lawrence approves it, you get your sticker, you get your approval from the Office of Planning and Zoning. If for some reason you don't meet one of those criteria or if the director has concerns about it, you're kicked out or you're put into another path, which means you'd have to go to the Board of Adjustment.
Okay,
it's sort of
I
just
see.
There's a way to do it, it's just not that way.
Yeah.
I just, I didn't know for sure.
It's one of those things
what you
meant
would do to people who say it's kicked out. I heard you talk about produce stands on A1 property is perfectly fine. Are you saying it's perfectly fine if it's out in front of the property where it was grown?
That's right, because that's
or
what
the side of the road.
That's
or what?
The existing provision of our code in the AR1, which we're not talking about here today. But yeah, if it's on your property and you're selling produce that's grown on your property, either there or on another site.
It can be sold, and even if it's grown on another site.
Yeah, I think that amendment went through.
Yeah, it's grown on property that you own, even if it's not the same exact location, or property that you lease.
Right.
Majority of farmers lease large tracts of land.
Yes, so you have a little control over it. Okay, are any of these, I'm thinking about what I just heard, some of them have their own cooking facility where they're going to be, doing chickens and what. Are we talking about that and, and the sales end of it or not? In other words, does that affect anything?
Well, like we talked about, if you're an existing chicken barbecue stand, it wouldn't affect you. But, yeah, I mean, that's a food vendor. So if you're a new one coming to the county that you want to operate, you'd have to go through this.
But that's included. Mm-hmm. You can cook it right there. Okay. And when you say...
Those criteria. That's right.
What's that?
As long as you meet the criteria in here.
And that's included.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you say tables, I'm not sure what you mean. I have one in my area that's... I'm sure it's grandfathered in. But look at me. I'm the first one I look at. It's got three... picnic tables out front, and it's starting to look like a restaurant. So that would not come.
No, under the policy that we're working on, again, depending on how this goes today, just sort of working through different options on this. The thought was it was one table. That way, it keeps it small in size. You know, in terms
one
of
one table.
Yeah.
You mean for people to sit.
To sit, that's right.
Not a table on which you put your
produce. No, one table for people mm-hmm. to sit. Because then if you had, you know, you don't want it to turn into a sit-down outdoor restaurant, like you said. If mm-hmm. if it's going to get beyond one table, then you would have to go to the Board of Adjustment. That yeah. way people would have an opportunity to
okay.
participate.
Okay, I didn't see that in there, but maybe that's because when it's silent.
Well, it's not in the ordinance. Again,
right.
like we talked about, we wanted to get the ordinance through and then have a policy for implementing it, and we're working on the policy.
Okay, that will be there. Okay, and these would be reviewed by planning and zoning people?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Oh, one last clarification. This was primarily for food trucks, basically food type of vendors.
Well, it started out originally for fairly wide open, and then we dialed it down. Food and agricultural products, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it is stated in there. So if somebody comes in and wants to, you know, sell these velvet wall hangings of Elvis, they can't do that.
Or of George Cole.
No, this is for edibles.
No, they're allowed that. That's permitted. Okay, now I just want to make sure that don't look at, like, because I've been to areas where you go to intersections and you see, and it looks like you're in some bazaar in the mm-hmm. Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Sell rugs, too.
Or in somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know. And all I can just say is, you know, we were trying to make something quick and clean, and we're going to probably have some bumps in the road. So let's stop talking and probably... Okay. Listen to anybody else.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cole.
Congratulations.
Any more questions to council?
If not, is there anyone that would like to speak in regards to this matter?
Popcorn is not going to be permitted, is it?
Sure it is.
It's agricultural.
I don't know. Not, we don't grow popcorn.
I'm gonna
How do you grow popcorn?
I'm going to sell it right in front of your house.
I wonder...
Pole bean. Can you have a pole bean vendor?
You ain't going to interfere with that pole bean, I guarantee you. But you better bring a whole lot of people if you're going to stop me on them. Because you're going to starve me. You wouldn't be buying any beans.
Please tell Mr. Kramer not to address the council personally.
And let me tell you,
he's direct. I think he's direct.
At that rate, he gets my grits. I got the floor now. And I'm going to keep it for a while.
3 minutes?
First of all, I think there was one issue I want to know. I want a clarification on this. Because I do know this was discussed. A requirement of having a state license when these guys come in and get approved. True or not?
You need a business license.
True, the ordinance does require a state of Delaware business license.
Well, then I really got a real question. If you're going to enforce that law, because that's a state law, that is not a county law, which you have no right to even enforce.
True.
Huh?
True.
Well, then I got this question. When Hocker came in here, got a zoning change for his thing, and three or four since that time, did you ask them guys, did they have a license? Then don't come out here and ask me for my license, even though I already have one. That's not kosher at all. And then on top of that, when this thing first came up was when I approached this issue back when Hocker was here, wanting to know why he was being had to do this when he already owned the land that should have been a given. And now they got to come in and they got to kiss blank to get something?
I got news for you. I ain't going to kiss him at all. He's too dang ugly.
He'd probably appreciate that.
Wait. You're accusing him of being ugly?
You're his brother, so go ahead. You're right in the same boat.
I'm moving right along.
And that anyhow, work,
now, the next question work. I have, and most of you know, I sell kettle corn popcorn. Now, let's say you have...
You do?
And by the way, it's world famous. It's been shipped all over the world.
It is good.
At least he admits it.
It's his wife's kettle corn.
I know.
Oh, there you go.
That's all my opinion, George.
Anyhow, let's say you've got a guy here, comes in and gets approved. He's a food vendor. But the guy that owns the property one day decides, well, he wants to have me come over there and set up for just a day. Where do I fit into the picture there? Because I got news for you. I'm going to come up there and I'm going to sit there. And by the way, oh, you got into regulations, it's only 8 foot wide? Well, guess what? My tent is 10 foot wide. And not only that, then you have it. You can't go in an AR district. Catch me, because I'm going in. Try to stop me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to address this issue? Anyone else? Saw a gentleman back here. I think you came up earlier.
Yes. Look.
I hope you sell kettle corn too, because
mine's in the 8 foot.
Good job.
I don't have nothing to worry about there.
All abiding kettle corn, man. Okay.
If you can give us your name and address, please.
My name is Lou D'Amico. I'm from Lewis, and I have a concession trailer, barbecue, and I just want to say thanks. You know, I'm a small business and try to do everything the right way, and this is a huge help for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We did something right.
Yes, there's a place to sign with your name and address, please.
I got a pen. I'll look for my glasses.
Okay. Is there anyone else that would like to address this issue? Is there anyone else that would like to speak in reference to this ordinance? If not, Mr. President, we can close the public hearing on this matter.
Close the public hearing. Okay, with counsel, close public comment. And I ask Mr. Moore to read the short title. And pleasure, counsel.
There were some proposed amendments to this. I'll read the short title with those proposed amendments so we can vote on those, and then we'll vote on it as amended.
Sure.
Okay. An ordinance to amend Chapter 115, Article 10, Section 69 and 72, Article 11, Section 77 and 80, and Article 11A, Section 83.2 and 83.6 of the Code of Sussex County relating to temporary removable vendor stands, as amended as follows. The first one is temporary removable vendor stands included but not limited to food trucks and similar vehicles or trailers located on the premises between March 15th and November 15th for the sale of food, agricultural products, or other food-related goods. Such temporary removable vendor stands must comply with the following requirements. That's the amendment, which has been added in instead of the 6 months. The second one is under I. The sections 1, 2, and 3 should be amended to add a new section I to state the approval of a temporary removable vendor stand shall be valid for 1 year. The third amendment is sections 1, 2, and 3 should be amended to add a new section J to state J, the application for a temporary removable vendor stand shall be in a form established by the director. The fee for the for filing the application shall be $100.
I have a question too.
Let's get a motion then.
Okay.
And a second.
Then I'll make a motion.
Motion, Mrs. Deaver. Second, Mr.
Second
Cole.
To adopt the amendments.
Questions on a motion, Mrs. Cole.
Forgive me, but I didn't get the first thing you said. This ordinance would include, but not relate to, I don't know, food products. It is strictly food products.
That's correct. It's included.
Okay, so
yeah.
Then yeah. That's lawyer talk. Yeah, so I got right. It now. Thank you very much.
Any more questions on this motion? We're voting on the amendments.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Take the vote, Mrs. Deaver.
Yes.
Mr. Cole.
Yes.
Mr. Arlette.
Yes.
Mr. Wilson.
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried.
Okay.
Now we'll read it. We'll do the proposed ordinance as amended.
Yes. An ordinance to amend Chapter 115, Article 10, Section 69 and 72, Article 11, Section 77 and 80, and Article 11A, Sections 83.2 and 83.6 of the Code of Sussex County relating to temporary removable fender stands as amended.
Mm-hmm. So moved.
Motion, second. Mr. Cole, second. Mrs. Deaver. Any questions on the motion? We'll take the vote. Mrs. Deaver?
Yes.
Mr. Cole?
Yes.
Mr. Arlett?
Yes, very happy to support small business in Sussex County.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I know it's taken a little longer than you thought, but it's
thank you, guys.
We're there.
Thank you.
You're not going to bill us, are you?
Thank you.